about what the Mishkan would look like and how the Kohens would be dressed. Would you have made the assumption that it was going to be bejeweled and all this kind of stuff?
Yeah. This is something that annually troubles you. And ostentation, does God need it? In the morning, we recite this bracha for Birkas HaTorah. Very neutral bracha. Bracha that Hashem has commanded us to immerse ourselves in the study of Torah. And it says, the Ha'arav Na, Hashem is doing Torah spoofing. Make the words sweet in our mouth. You know, we don't find, generally speaking, that when we make a bracha on a mitzvah, that we ask Hashem to make the mitzvah sweet. But here we do. And I think one of the things is because here we're dealing with Hashem's will. We're studying Hashem's will. We're studying Hashem's wisdom. And obviously it's not even a drop in the ocean of Hashem's wisdom, but it's, you know, what's accessible to us. And it's our closest contact with God, in a sense. Torah is our closest contact with God as well. It's, so to speak, kind of thinking he wants us to have.
More so than prayer?
Huh?
More so than prayer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thinking, prayer is our thinking.
Uh-huh.
Torah is God's thinking. I'm not telling you that the time necessarily is more, but it's a different kind. But this is God's thought, so to speak. So God is the ultimate good. Our concept of the reward in eternity is to have the privilege of learning God's wisdom, knowing that wisdom is so exalted, so uplifting, that there is no greater reward, there is no greater pleasure than receiving that constant elevation of more and more wisdom. That's the direction that our eternity takes. So the thing that we're concerned about is that we could study Torah on our own level. We could study Torah or trying to force Torah so that it conforms to our minds. In which case, we're going to take Torah and we're going to detach it from its source. And when we do so, when it conforms to our configurations, it will be very dependent on who and what we are. And it's entirely possible that we will distort it and that we won't experience it as being part of God's wisdom. We'll experience it with our own experience, we'll experience it within our own limited ways, and we'll see it in our own limited ways. So we could, for example, we could see the fact that women are not obligated to sit in the sukkah. Depending on who we are, we could see it as a denigration of women. We might justify that, or we might choose a denigration of women and be upset about it. But whatever the case is, and by the fact that we impute to God something which is really not particularly uplifting, the result will be that we will not, the Torah that we immerse ourselves in will not be felt as being sweet. And what we're saying to God is, God, I want to experience your Torah as being sweet, because that's one of the indications that I'm studying your Torah, not my Torah. That's the Haravah. Hashem, make it sweet. Make it sweet for me, because then I'll know that I'm studying your Torah. If I'm studying my Torah, I'm not going to. At best, it will be bland. You know, so I'll say, oh, it's like, yeah, so the carburetor feeds the gas into the motor, and then the motor, whatever. I don't get high on that. I'm not going to get excited about that. But if I'm studying Torah and I understand the fact that if Reuven's ox gores Shimon's ox, then you have to whatever you do such and such. And I understand the halachas that relate to that. I should experience that as being sweet, because that's part of, you know, it deals with some very ordinary things. I should experience it being sweet, because it's God's ratzon. And obviously a lot has to do with how I approach it. So if I sit down and learn and I'm interested in amassing information, or I'm just interested in becoming someone that people will treat with deference because I'm a Talmud Chacham, I'm not going to experience borscht. But if I sit down and my attitude is, Hashem, I'm sitting down because this is your ratzon and I want to become close to your ratzon, then I have a chance of experiencing it as being sweet. But the experiencing it as being sweet is one of the indicators that I'm in the right place. You know, if you're playing hot and cold, they're trying to find something and you're getting colder and colder, you know, you get, if you're not experiencing Torah sweet, it's an indication that something's wrong. You know, back up, because you're studying with your mind, but when you're studying it, there is a very unique, sublime quality to the thing. You experience it as an extraordinary pleasure. There's nothing sweeter in the world than that, those moments. As a corollary to that, there are things in the world which came into the world because of the fact that they were to allow for people to, in a certain sense, be moved by beauty and grandeur, so that they would be able to relate to the fact that God's perfection is felt in the world, in the majesty of mountain peaks, in the vastness of the ocean, and the expanses of the starry skies, and the beauty of a diamond or a sapphire, or that you look into this gem, or you look at the brilliance of gold or silver when it's, you know, and it says to you, this comes from that. It kind of leads you in the direction of beauty. It leads you in the direction of the fact that, well, there are a lot of things in the world that are painful and dark and ugly and coarse and whatever, but there's a source in the world of things that are, take your breath away, they tell you this comes from, these things come from a very magnificent place. Most of those things, with the exception of the grandeur of nature, are things where a man becomes a partner, or becomes a partner in polishing a gem, bringing out the beauty of a gem, or performing magnificent things with gold and silver and stuff. But The Medrash says that certain things were created so that they would be the kinds of things that would surround the presence of God. So the wood, for example, that was used in the Beis HaMikdash. The Medrash says that in reality, mankind should not be allowed to use that wood for anything else, because the only reason that wood was made is so that it would be used for the Mishkan. So if we use that wood to make a chair with, that we're really taking from something that came into the world only for the purpose of...
like the multicolored animal.
Or like the multicolored animal. But in a certain sense, all of the gold and all of the silver and all of this stuff, really, it's in other words, we say like this, we say so we have all these things which are there for man, right, that are part of man's acquisition of wealth and the acquisition of power and all this stuff. So now, and these are the kinds of things that people use to show off in presentations. So now, God doesn't need that. So why are we, quite the contrary, you would argue that a place that God would have made for himself would be the most elegant simplicity. It would be the just nothing. Because God doesn't need that. The problem with that is that we got that once again, it's a problem of the tail wagging the dog. The reason that those things are there in the world, the reason that we have gold and silver is because they reflect different sources of God's majesty and God's beauty, and they're meant that man should look at them and be swept up in that majesty and be moved to relate to a world which is beautiful, or to a being who's the source of all beauty. In Chassidus, there's constant reminders, really. It's associated with classical Chassidish thought. And Baal Shem HaKadosh said, whenever something comes into your life, remember that there's a form of it which appears in a much higher form. So that, for example, if someone during the course of his day finds that he has he's drawn by desire to whatever it is, could be any kind of a pleasure. So if he could stop himself and say to himself, where does pleasure come into the world? What's the source of pleasure? It's not, it doesn't have a life of its own. So where does pleasure come from? And say to himself, well, pleasure really comes from the very highest form of pleasure, which is God. And you say to yourself, well, why should I be involved with a gumball for a penny? Why should I pay a penny for a gumball when what this gumball is really telling me is there's something which is $1 billion worth of pleasure that if I elected, I could really divert my attention to that source and do something to connect me with that. What am I doing with petty nonsense when I could be involved with something? I'm not even talking about these are all permissible pleasures, but the point of it is that what Chassidus says is that these things happen as though in a certain sense God was trying to get our attention by dropping pennies. When I was learning Aleph Beis, whenever I was, I don't know, 4 years old, so there was a little old Jew by the name of Reuven Lichtig, European Jew with a little white beard. So I remember he would sit me down, he had a Rishon Stasser Aleph Beis, and he would say, this is an Aleph, and when I would say Aleph, and all of a sudden, a penny. stage. And I said, Reb Reuben, where did they come from? He said to me, a malach. An angel sent them. So, well, this was good business. So, Bays.
More letters here.
Yeah, more letters. Bays, another penny. Kimmel, you know. I was raking it in. And he had me sold on this idea that this was a malach. Well, this is different couple of days. One day I turned around and my father was pitching pennies. From the disc. So I flipping his penny.
So he was right. It did come.
Yeah. But Hashem is pitching pennies. He's pitching pennies. And, you know, so it comes in the form of some pleasure. Go, you know, do this thing. So instead of relating to the penny, I'm going to turn around and I could have been hugged by my father. You know, it would have been a much deeper experience. The problem is, at that age, I probably would have rather opted for the penny. And in many of our own instances, we opt for the pennies. Instead of saying to ourselves, God is trying to get my attention, why don't I go right to the source where the kind of connection that I will have will bring me, if not immediately, but in the long run, an experience of pleasure that is not in any which way capable of even entering the world, because the world is too limited for me to experience. So the fact that there is gold and silver in the world, or that there are diamonds and sapphires and opals and whatever else, that all of these things that when you look at them, you know, you really, they are beautiful. And the reason that they're precious is because they are beautiful. And when you look at something magnificent in gold or something magnificent in silver, they are really beautiful. Isn't that? Oh, they're beautiful. I want you to put this into my house because I need this. They're beautiful because God initially brought them into the world so that people would look at them and say, this kind of majesty, this kind of beauty has a source. And God is pitching pennies my way. So I should be drawing out. The point is that all of these things are there. They're in the world only because they're associated with God. Now mankind has appropriated them for his own purpose, and now he's in our zone. When God is asking me to make a place for him, so he wants to be surrounded by riches. That's the tail wag. The only reason these things are in the world is because they're associated with God, and they belong to him. And when we make a place for him, those are the things we need to bring there, because that's why they're in the world in the first place. They're there in the world because they're close to him. The Torah is by taste sweet. And these things, I find on occasion that some things automatically draw me. When I look at this, we flew over I'm assuming they were the
Rocky Mountains
when we were flying west this time. It's just so magnificent. I mean, you look at them, and there's a grandeur. And they draw you to the architect. They draw you to the artist. And there are times that I find that sometimes you look into a beautiful, some of these colors, I don't know, like some of these deep blues or stuff that you look into, these precious gems. There is something in a very, so it's, even though it's a sight thing, but it strikes a deeper chord in you. In other words, the chord that it strikes is majesty. It appeals to it. It's not like there's something that are just hit your eye and that's where it stops. But the Torah is experienced in a much deeper way than it really is experienced in. To say that it's sweet, I mean, it's like trying to describe, somebody says to you, who's never inhaled a fragrant aroma. So you, let's say incense, whatever, I mean, not incense, what do you call it? Balsamic.
Spices.
Yeah, aromatic spices. What is the spell, the one that we ordinarily use? No. Cloves. Cloves. They never smelled cloves in their life. So, say, ah, this is true. I smelled cloves. Well, what did it smell like? Oh, it was very sweet. Sweet like what? Sweet like sugar? Sweet like, you know, like orange juice. I mean, you know, how do you explain it? There's no way to explain it. All you can say
like
it's
a strawberry.
You can't. There's certain things you can't describe. You can't describe the sweetness of Torah because it's a sweetness which is not the sweetness of sugar. It's experienced in a way which the only way we can describe it is it's very pleasant. It's very sweet. It's very whatever, you know, flower. You put it under an electron microscope and you see the infinite